Chapter 2. Boundaries.
I look at myself from the outside and I think, I'm really smart. I'm not average looking. I am very, very successful. And what the fuck am I doing?
Vanessa is a confident, professionally successful woman in her mid-40s. She's a single mother of a teenage son and travels the world in support of her high-powered career. But for her impressive resume, there's one glaring problem.
I have been in an affair with somebody that I care about and love very much for almost 3 years.
She's in love with a married man. Here she is in our preliminary phone call.
It's in his control. Like, if I don't get an email from him or something, then it's like, oh, he doesn't care about me. He doesn't do this. And why? I don't know how to get out of that.
Yeah.
If I can get out of that, that will lead to me getting out of the relationship.
The thing about situations like this, too, is they're never intellectually difficult. Like, you're not doing rocket science. They're emotionally difficult. And because they're emotionally difficult, you know, the brain finds a million different reasons to justify it and let it continue. The goal here is to end this and is to find a way to move on, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that there's no other goal.
Okay. I got a confession to make. This is going to sound really fucked up, but I love causing breakups. I know. Hear me out. People usually come to me because they're unhappy and they want to be happy. Most people assume that if you're at unhappy and want to get to happy, it's because you got to get rid of the pain in your life. But I've always argued the opposite. Getting from unhappy to happy is usually about diving into the pain in your life. It's about owning up to your struggles, accepting the consequences of your choices, and of course, having the difficult conversations that we avoid. So, in a counterintuitive way, I don't help people get from unhappy to happy. I help them deal with their pain. And if they can deal with their pain well, then I guess happy happens. Because of this approach, I often get weird emails where people are extremely excited or proud of painful moments in their lives. The most common of which is the breakup email. It usually goes something like this. Mark, I've been stuck in a bad relationship for 10 years, and after reading your work, I finally had the courage to leave that ass face. Thanks a million, XOXO. When I get these emails, I do a little dance in my office chair. I am the anti-Cupid, the destroyer of romantic worlds, and I love it. Research shows that our relationships have some of the biggest impacts on our emotional well-being and mental health. Arguably, the most important decision you make in your life is who your partner is. Therefore, throwing off a bad relationship that is hurting you, to me, is one of the healthiest things you can do. So when Vanessa came to me and said that this relationship was hurting her and she didn't know how to get out, I was like, fuck yeah, let's do this.
Almost 4 years ago, I began a friendship with Vince, and he's like my best friend. It got me from the start. I work in a very difficult environment that politically and strategically, there's always everything going on. And from the beginning, he saw through everything, and he was new, and I showed him around, and we became very good friends. And about 6 months into that, it became more than friends.
How did this thing start?
My job, I work incredible hours.
Yeah.
And he also works odd hours. He asked me one night, like it was almost midnight and I needed to get to my car. And he was like, he was always really good about saying, okay, that's enough. You need to go home. And obviously I didn't really want to go home because home sucked. So
yeah.
You know, if I'm good at my job, I might as well stay here. At least one thing's going well. And he said, well, I'll give you a ride to your car. And at that moment I knew that was a make or break moment. I knew that there was a potential for it to be more in that moment, and I wanted it to be more.
Yeah.
And it was okay. And so we drove around a little bit, and he parked and he asked if he could kiss me. And I said yes. And from there, it just escalated, not in that moment, but
right.
It was funny because when we did start it, it was said to be from both of us, like, this is just the physical part. It doesn't have anything to do with our friendship. We're not going to fall in love, all of that. And a few weeks later, he came to me and he said, I know that I said all these things, but I've fallen in love with you. And I knew I had already fallen in love with him. And that's the hard part, is that there's this logical part to all of this, and there's this stupid emotional part that is what keeps me rooted there in it, because he knows me better than anybody else. He knows all of my, like, all of the bad and all of the good.
Yeah.
And, like, the trouble and the trauma, all of it. So, like, how do you give up somebody who knows everything and still loves you besides, you know, even because of it? And at about a year into it, he got caught by his wife. And the shit hit the fan, literally. Like, it was crazy. Not literally, but he does not have a very good relationship at home. I think it's very, and I'm going to need you, because I will sugarcoat, or I will try to make him a better person than what I'm sure he is. So feel free.
This last statement by Vanessa is key. It demonstrates an awareness that she is biased and that her emotions likely prevent her from being objective about the situation. Self-awareness is the fundamental skill for any behavioral change. The truth is that our minds are quite imperfect and self-serving. We're all biased and prejudiced in favor of our own emotions. If we love somebody, we will naturally overlook red flags and inappropriate behaviors. If we hate somebody, we will amplify any wrongdoing they may have done. If we are desperate, we will perceive any attention as affection. And if we are narcissistic, we will naturally make absolutely everything about us. We all do it. So the ability to notice our own emotions and responses to those emotions is paramount. What Vanessa says here is basically, I know I'm not able to be rational about this guy, so please call me out when I need to hear it. As a coach or mentor or advice-giving person, this is exactly what I love to hear, especially so early into our first conversation. Many people don't realize that being helped is its own form of skill, and the willingness to receive feedback like that signifies that Vanessa will likely be easy to help. Now that I've learned a bit more about the relationship and how it started, I ask her to tell me about her relationship history. I want to see if there are any patterns here. So what's the background story?
He had married his high school sweetheart, and so had I.
Okay.
I know on my end, it's because I didn't know any better. I will tell you that on the day I got married, I absolutely thought about climbing out the bathroom window.
Really?
Yeah. That should have been my first clue.
Yeah, that's kind of a red flag.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, 24, I didn't know that. So I think I fell into the very thing that everybody falls into in an affair. When you're with somebody, you think, okay, well, here's our make or break moment. And I took that as a moment and I left my husband. He did not leave his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm glad I did. I think at the time I said I was leaving for him, but mm-hmm. really I think I was just looking for a way out, and I took the first to get out.
Well, and if you were having an affair, you couldn't have been too satisfied with the marriage to begin with. So.
Exactly. I grew up taking care of other people, and I was still taking care of this person. And we have a son, and taking care of him too. And I was the primary, I guess, breadwinner in the family. I supported him through layoffs. And, you know, I just was really like, I'm done. But mm-hmm. I used Vince as the way to get out.
Yeah.
And that's the reason. And I held on to that for such a long time. Like, I can't believe I left and you didn't. You led me to believe all these other things. And in a way, yes, that is absolutely true. He did. But when I look back at what I was responsible for, I was just responsible for leaving no matter what.
Yeah.
So I take that to heart.
I just want to interject here to point out that infidelity is almost never a clear-cut thing. People usually don't cheat because they're bad people. They cheat because something's broken, either within themselves or within the relationship, and they have no idea how to address it or even approach it. The cheating becomes a kind of outlet for them. What's striking about Vanessa's situation is that while she cheated on her husband, it ended up being the thing that gave her the permission to leave a terrible marriage. So while it's not admirable, it was also, strangely, an important step for her from a personal growth standpoint. We all like to judge our relationship choices as virtuous or evil or whatever, but the truth is, the vast majority lie within some ambiguous gray area. That's part of what makes relationships so difficult.
Let's back up a little bit. Let's talk about your first marriage.
Okay.
It was your high school sweetheart.
Yes.
How old were you when you met?
I was 16 and he was 18.
Was there a period of time that it was good and it was joyful, or was it all...
I think the first part of it was good. We were both young and I think both of us got married because we didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
So the fact that we were together for 8 years before we decided to get married, and we got married because it was just what we thought we should do, seems like pretty much the best definition of it. And I didn't know that I wasn't going to like all these things about him because I hadn't grown into myself yet. So I think things drastically changed when we had Jake.
Okay. And how did they change?
I had to take on even more, and it was clear that the child relationship was more important to me than it was to my ex-husband. He didn't do so well. He obviously, there's adjustments. Like, there's a screaming child who needs care, and he wasn't really happy about that. But I think more along the lines of he was used to being kind of pampered himself, and he was the first son and the only boy in a very cultural family where that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And so some of that had to go by the wayside just because life gets tiring.
Yeah.
And I don't think he could ever see a longer picture. So things started to get bad then.
Okay.
And he drinks.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. How a lot?
Like every day.
So like alcoholic a lot.
Yeah, alcoholic a lot.
Okay. Did he ever get treatment or no?
No, he didn't believe me that it was an issue.
Okay.
He just, grew up in a family where that's what you do. I knew it was never going to be forever.
Yeah.
And I was in it. I think what every woman's been taught to do, that you stick it out until the kid turns 18 and everything will be better then, or you can leave then. And mm-hmm. I took the first train out.
Okay. So you did wait till the kid was 18.
I almost made it.
Yeah.
I bailed when he was 14. We share custody, but I have him more than he does. And the fucking kicker of all of it is I pay alimony. Yeah.
Hey, 21st century, equal rights, right?
Yes. But I would think that if that was like the case, I would think yes. But I feel like I'm constantly being punished for my own stupidity and not seeing that this was a deadbeat when I did. So I feel a little like, the seventh ring of hell or something, where keep rolling that ball up because you have a lesson to learn.
Wow.
That's the marriage. I mean, so, it didn't end well. And right now we're barely on speaking terms.
Okay. Did he find out about Vince?
No.
Okay. This is a good time to go over the basics of boundaries. Because from the way she describes her previous marriage, I already have a good idea of what Vanessa's issue is. In a healthy relationship, both people take responsibility for their own actions and emotions and expect the other person to take responsibility for their actions and emotions. Let's imagine my wife has a work trip. I stay at home and feel lonely and sad. If I blame her for my sadness, saying it's her fault that I'm sad, that is a boundary violation. My sadness is my emotion, and it's based on how I've chosen to perceive things. Therefore, it is my responsibility. Let's say I'm so sad that I drink myself into a stupor and wreck the car. Even worse, I blame her for the wrecked car, saying, if you had been home, I wouldn't have been sad and wouldn't have driven drunk. that's an even deeper boundary violation, as now I'm not only holding her responsible for my feelings, but also my actions that resulted from those feelings. This type of blaming is actually disempowering, because when I make my wife responsible for how I feel or how I act, I remove my ability to control my own life. There's a flip side to this boundary violation. Let's say I'm cool staying at home alone, but my wife feels bad. She feels guilty that she left me here by myself. She starts calling constantly, sending me little gifts and notes. Now she's taking responsibility for how I feel, and that, too, is a boundary violation. She doesn't get to decide how I feel or what I do with those feelings. I'm a big boy. I can handle myself. People do this stuff all the time in subtle and unknowing ways. Jerry holds himself responsible for his partner's feelings, and as a result, fails to state what he wants or needs. Mimi fails to hold men accountable for their actions, therefore ceding control of her emotions to them. Vanessa, so far, appears to be cut from a similar cloth. Let's call people who expect others to take responsibility for their actions and emotions narcissistic. They are the type of people who will break some glassware in a fit of anger and then blame their partner for it. The narcissist's favorite line is something like, "See what you made me do," or the nicer sounding cousin, "I only did it because I love you." No, fuckface, you did it because you're a selfish asshole. Put on your big boy pants and take responsibility for grandma's broken china vase. Now, let's call people who take responsibility for the actions and emotions of others codependents. Codependents constantly feel guilty about the world around them. If their partner is hungry or angry or tired, they feel that it's their job to make them feel better. If their partner screws up and loses their job, the codependent takes it upon themselves to fix the situation for them. On the surface, codependents are nice and helpful to a fault. But like narcissists, they are subtly making everything about themselves. If a narcissist is upset or sad or angry, they will demand that their partner make them feel better rather than attempt to feel better themselves. If a narcissist fucks up or makes a mistake, they will hold their partner responsible rather than themselves. If a narcissist is unsatisfied with the relationship, they will assume it's their partner's fault. As a result, narcissists tend to go through relationships like pairs of uncomfortable underwear, each one feeling dissatisfying and unfair in its own way. Meanwhile, if a codependent is upset, sad, or angry, they will blame themselves because they don't want to be a burden to their partner. If a codependent's partner fucks up or makes a mistake, they will feel responsible to try to make everything okay for their partner, even if it means sacrificing themselves. If a codependent is unsatisfied with the relationship, they will assume that it's because they didn't do enough. They didn't make their partner happy enough. They didn't work hard enough. As a result, codependents often get taken advantage of for years on end and then are promptly dumped, having no clue it was coming. Interestingly, narcissists and codependents tend to attract each other. It makes sense. Both have poor boundaries. And while the narcissist has a never-ending need to be saved and fixed, the codependent has a never-ending need to save and fix others. The narcissist's need to constantly abandon responsibility for themselves is met only by the codependent's need to constantly take responsibility for others, and thus, the toxic cycle begins. The problem with this toxic cycle of narcissism and codependence is that it requires boundary violations in order to function. The narcissist needs someone to clean up their messes to feel loved and important. Therefore, they find ways to make messes. Similarly, the codependent needs to clean up someone's mess to feel loved and important. So they subtly encourage their partner to make a mess so that they can come and clean it. This dynamic plays out in a few ways. You have the breaker and fixer dynamic, where the narcissist repeatedly breaks the relationship so the codependent can continually fix it right up. You have the runner and chaser dynamic, where the narcissist is always running away from intimacy and the codependent is constantly trying to catch them and pin them down. Then you have the victim-savior dynamic, where the narcissist is always being hurt and victimized by the world and the codependent gets to be the knight in shining armor who saves them. These patterns explain all bad rom-coms and pop music. You're welcome. In each case, the narcissist and the codependent behave this way for the same reason: to prove to themselves that they are loved and needed. Both base their happiness on their partner's actions and not their own. Both see their identity and self-worth as a function of their partner's approval and not their own. And therefore, while exhibiting completely opposite behaviors on the surface, both the narcissist and codependent are the same in that they are incapable of feeling good about themselves by themselves. Infidelity is, at its core, a boundary violation. Vince is not living up to his commitment with his wife and is therefore unavailable to commit to Vanessa. Vanessa, by being involved with the married man and constantly taking it upon herself to make it work, has allowed herself to take responsibility for a relationship that doesn't really exist, to give herself to a man who is incapable of giving himself back, to fix the pain that he seems to always be going through. And once Vanessa describes the character of her previous marriage, that basically her ex-husband was a deadbeat alcoholic and she spent the entire relationship taking care of him, supporting him, and covering for him, it's immediately clear what she is. Codependent.
High school sweetheart, young, didn't know any better, first love.
Yeah.
Got married because it's the right thing to do. Was there a lot of romance and passion early on in the relationship, or was it just kind of like...
No, there wasn't a lot of romance and passion, no.
Okay, so you could almost say that your first taste of like real intense romance and passion came with this affair?
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
I think that's very accurate.
Okay.
It could be the very reason why I keep holding on.
Yeah. I think that first round of intense passion in one's life is usually the most powerful. I think most people kind of experience that. It's the most intoxicating. And usually it kind of blows up in your face. And I think most people learn that lesson early on, that it's like, oh, well, just because that felt amazing doesn't mean it was amazing.
That's true. I know so that there's several aspects that aren't amazing about it.
Yeah, and so maybe you're a late bloomer, so to speak. You're getting your first round of dumb teenage love out at 40.
Yeah. I could, you know, that's probably so very accurate. because I can see that the reasons why I hold on.
Yeah.
I think my biggest fear is I am in my 40s. What if I don't find this?
Yeah, what if you don't find it again?
Yeah.
Because you've never found it before, so what?
Right.
You know, it makes sense.
Exactly. That's a giant fear.
No, I understand that. I understand that. I mean,
one of the reasons why I'm willing to put up with the crap part of it, but I'm kind of at this crossroads where I've got to figure out if I am okay with putting up with all of the crap, because there's a lot of crap.
And yeah. I would actually argue you're not even at that bridge yet. If he came to you and was like, you know what, I'm divorcing my wife and I really want to have a serious go at this, then you're at the bridge of, okay, is this worth putting up with the crap? Unfortunately, you're stuck at the bridge waiting for him because he's got a bunch of bridges he doesn't even want to cross yet. And, you know, that's up to him to do. And I think the reason we're here is he's not doing it. You know, there are some things about this situation that are totally within your power, but there are also things that are not. And sadly, the things that are not, it doesn't matter what you do, you know, it's not going to change anything.
There are so many indicators for good and indicators for bad with this relationship that I really don't know where I land or where I should land, because there's this whole moral versus and ethical versus law versus like what is really truthful that I struggle with. Because yes, I have somebody telling me by a piece of paper that what we're doing is wrong, but I also know that I'm my happiest when we're together. So it leads on. We continued, and then guess what? He got caught again. And that brought it to a real big head. And at that point, I stepped out because it was clear that his first response was to not fix it, but to just calm things down with her, not to take another opportunity to leave or to do whatever. So that happened for a few months, and it's been over a year. And we still talk, and we still continue our physical relationship as well, because that picked back up. But it's mostly the talking. I'm the person who's going to lose out on this, because it's clear he's not going to leave. And at some point, if he decides that he's had enough of this crazy life, it's me he's going to go. That's going to go. Not.
Yeah, let's start digging into the why. The way you describe this guy, it sounds like he has a chronic case of not taking responsibility for his relationships. But the thing is even if he gets pushed one way or the other, like even if, you know, in your mind, the best thing happened, which is he left his wife or his wife leaves him, you know, he's probably going to still have this tendency.
So that's the other part. Yeah, it is. That's the other part. I think that like the logical part of me knows that you can't control what other people do. You can only control how you respond to what they do and your own actions.
Yeah.
So I feel like if I'm waiting on somebody else, I'm letting them be responsible for my happiness. And that's bullshit.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. I mean, that's how I feel. And that's why I know that this is tough. And I'm not fighting like him or anything. I'm fighting myself on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I could walk away at any time, but I don't. And that's what's so infuriating and stupid all at the same time, that I do have this giant emotional tie to him and I love him very much. But I also am done letting him be responsible for my happiness.
This statement is hugely important. She says, I'm done letting him be responsible for my happiness. This suggests that on some level, Vanessa has become aware of her codependent tendencies and the boundary violations that come along with them. She wants to take responsibility for her own happiness. She also wants to stop herself from allowing him to dictate her emotions. The question is then, how? Can I ask really quickly, mm-hmm. have you yeah. tried dating? I mean, you are technically single, so have you tried dating other people?
So the answer to that is yes, and it has been a fucking disaster.
Okay.
So part of it, I've gone in a couple of different things. When I first fully separated from my ex-husband, I was like, I don't want to say I went wild, but I went wild for me personally. Okay. I dated this one colleague's friend, and it was nice, but they get so attached so quickly. And he went into this whole like how I'm raising my son and being a mom and how he wants kids. And I was like, whoa. There's not another child that's coming out of this. We did it right the first time. Like, no, I am not going to lose hours and hours and hours of sleep again. Plus, my kid's pretty awesome. So we're just going to leave it at that. So one of my really big faults, weaknesses, whatever, is because of how I grew up and obviously with my ex-husband, I am terrible at telling people no. Mm-hmm. I will be in a bat clearly. Oh, my God, this is like craziest thing I'm about to say, because feel free to laugh out loud. I will stay in a bad situation just because I don't want the other person to be upset.
Yeah.
Ha. Okay. Yeah. So I dated him and then he got really like clingy and crazy. So I backed off of that. I actually went out of my comfort zone and asked somebody else out that I met at the store, and he was very sweet. It was very nice. And then I think I have this superpower of being able to attract crazy. I'm really sure that this is a thing.
You know what they say, Vanessa, is the only thing all of your partners have in common.
It's me, right? Oh my God, I'm the crazy one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can own that.
She's not crazy necessarily. She's just codependent. So the men she attracts will typically be narcissists. They are the breakers to her inner fixer. What's interesting about people with poor boundaries is that they naturally seem to sort for each other in the dating process. When a narcissist meets a healthy person, the healthy person will refuse to take responsibility for the narcissist's bullshit, to save them, to fix them, or whatever. In fact, the healthy person will be repulsed by them. Similarly, if a healthy person meets a codependent, the codependent's constant desire to take responsibility for the healthy person's life will turn them off too. It's only once a narcissist and codependent meet each other that they experience that click of chemistry. It's just an unhealthy chemistry.
And then I gave it a break because Vince was kind of, I didn't tell him any of this, even though we kept saying, like, I kept hinting and saying, like, I think I should be doing this. And he's like, I know you can. I just don't want to hear about it. He just got really weird. So then I went to go see a therapist, and he didn't like me seeing her either because we would talk about him and it would show like that he's a bad guy. And I would go back and say, like, you know, I really need to like discuss this with you or that with you, or I would put down some boundaries. And the narcissistic side of him didn't like the people thinking
doesn't want that. Yeah.
I do have moments of clarity. I swear to God I do.
Well, it's interesting you said the thing about not being able to say no, because and it's interesting that you describe Vince as narcissistic, because generally narcissistic people, generally they attract relationships with people who are scared to death to say no to people. And so you get this really kind of toxic and ugly dynamic where one person is constantly afraid to say no, even though they should, and the other person is constantly terrified of hearing no, even though they probably should. Like, it would probably be good for him to have people start saying no to him. That would be the only thing that would probably be a wake-up call. I know you would hate this, but I'll throw you and his wife in the same boat on this
one.
Which
I
is like,
think it's true.
Like, both of you need to be saying no to him, because if both of you aren't able to do that, then there's no reason for him to ever change. You know, all he has to do is just sit there and like, oh, well, maybe they'll calm down. Maybe I'll say some nice things, maybe buy a gift or something, and like everybody will chill out. And he doesn't actually change anything. It's what it requires is either you or her, or preferably both of you, saying, hey, get your shit together. You're done. You know, unless you can prove to me that you've changed or that you are taking our relationship seriously, you're done. I don't want to see you again. And if one or both of you did that, I mean, it would be life-changing.
Exactly.
I mean, it would be a huge wake-up call for him. And so there's an irony here in that even though it may look from the outside that he's getting his cake and eating it too, like, it's not good for him either. And so, yeah, it just sucks for everybody.
It does. And it's so funny that you say that, because it's kind of where I've been. I've been telling him no. How do I say this? Like, not straight out like, hey, no. But, like, in my own way, not being available whenever he's available. I've started just going on my work trips and not telling him. I stopped sharing my calendar with him. So I am setting some type of boundaries, and I've noticed that they haven't, that at first it's like, that's not cool, but then I think he's getting an understanding of it. Like, I stopped waiting around for him.
Some of the things you said actually struck me. Him wanting to know where you are, who you're hanging out with, sharing a calendar with him. So even if you were happily married, with this guy, those strike me as potentially boundary violations.
Yeah. He does not like not knowing or having control. I'll give you that.
Yes. And again, even if you were happily married with this guy, that does not give him a right to know where you are or what you're doing at all times. And then especially since he's not even willing to fully commit to a relationship with you, he doubly doesn't get to know. He definitely doesn't have the right to know where you are, what you're doing at all times. So I definitely think pulling back on stuff like that is the right move.
Okay.
Describe to me the extent of your daily or weekly communication.
The communication?
Yeah.
So it's usually we have an email account that we share.
Okay.
It's usually like a daily thing. He likes it when I say good morning and good night. And then during the day, he always says, like, he likes to know, not, he makes it seem like it's not a weird way, but just like what is going on in my life, like what meetings I'm having, just like what are the things I'm running into, because he knows a lot of the players.
Yeah.
But he doesn't give that in return. It's a lot of like radio silence, or I'll hear from him like once a day, like having a really busy day, or, and he tries to call my office. And if I'm there, I'll answer. If I'm not, I don't. We usually end up having good phone conversations. He always likes to know like which weekends I have my son and which I don't, so that if an opportunity comes up, he'll want to see me. But then I usually never hear from him. I'll hear like a good night or, but what'd you do today? Like, I don't know what's going on in his life, but he wants to know what's going on in mine. Like, hey, would you, and he makes it sound like it's a friendly thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like when I don't respond, he goes, going nuts is not the right word to say, but he gets cranky.
He gets upset.
Yeah. Like right now I can tell he's a bit upset. For two reasons. Cause this morning all I got was like a good night, I'm missing you. And there's usually like indicators that you know when things are okay and when things are not. Like he'll use endearments when everything's fine.
Yeah.
When there's no endearments, then I'm like, okay, that's when my spidey sense comes up. So I try to make it better. Like just then I'll give some more information, or I just am like, okay, his ego needs some sort of soothing. He likes to call it untethered. I'm out in the world just, you know, doing my thing. And I don't think he likes not being a part of that.
Yeah, but at the same time, if he wanted to be a part of that, he could.
Exactly. That's what I say to myself all the time. Like, it's his choice.
Yeah.
Notice how one-sided these interactions are. He wants to know about her meetings, but when she asks about his life, she gets no answers. He's insecure, and so he relies on her to constantly allay his insecurities. To keep him happy, Vanessa gives up more and more of her privacy, effectively mortgaging her own identity in the process. This is a classic example of a toxic relationship.
Tethering behavior like this, it comes from a place of insecurity. The same way you're afraid to say no to people because it might upset them, they might reject you. It's people who constantly want to keep others tethered. It's the same thing. It's like, they're afraid of losing them or being hurt by them. So they feel like if they can always keep tabs and always know where they are and what they're doing. And another strategy that people like this do a lot is they open shared email accounts and shared Facebook accounts. And it's because it's like the more stuff like that you create, the harder it is for the other person to disconnect.
Yeah.
It's not like he's nefarious and planning this in his basement, but like, it is designed from like an unconscious level to keep you tied to him. It's designed to put you in the situation you are in now, which is like, I want to let this go, but I don't know how, because there's all these little rituals and things that are keeping us tied together. I'm going to take a complete shot in the dark and say that maybe this paternalistic tethering, maybe you grew up without a father figure around, and maybe that has something to do with this, but...
I grew up with the wrong father.
Okay.
How's that to say? He was around. He was always around. He was this kind of abusive.
Gotcha. Okay. Compared to that, this still feels like love. So...
Yeah. It's probably the best kind that I've ever had.
Yeah. And it is a better form of love, but it's still not... It's a form of love that feels good, but it can't last. It doesn't respect the autonomy of each individual, and so it ultimately leads to bad relationships. I want to give a little bit of homework. Tell me if this feels unrealistic or like just impossibly painful.
If you tell me to go back on Match.com, I will say
no. It's impossible.
That's
I'll never
impossible.
Do it.
Yes, never.
Well, I will say that I do think it's a good idea that you continue to try dating other men. Worst case scenario, you see some guys that you don't feel a whole lot for. But, you know, you never know. If you find a guy that is kind of interesting, or you start developing something kind of nice, it can create a little bit of that hope of like, hey, maybe there is something good out there. So I would encourage you to keep that going okay. on the side if you can. But I think we need to continue untethering you okay. because honestly, healthy love is an untethered love. You know, it's when each individual is free to go do whatever they want. Not whatever they want, but like go where they want, stay out, see different people. It should not be an issue. If you trust the person and if you are committed to the person, then you're happy for them to go live their lives. If this is ever going to be a healthy relationship, it would have to be untethered anyway.
That's true.
I think getting off that email account is probably a great next step. I mean, if he wants to talk to you, he can call you or text you. And I think these daily updates...
Stops.
You should not feel obligated to update him on your life. And he'll get upset. He'll get cranky. So prepare for that.
Okay.
But if it's that important to him, he's going to come to you and he's going to say, like, look, like, let's talk about this more. Or he'll just throw a fit and get really upset and sulk and be cranky. And you'll be a little bit more untethered. Because ultimately, I think the end game here is give him the ultimatum of like, look, I'm done. And, you know, one day if you get divorced and sign your papers and everything, we can talk. But until that day, I'm done with this. And so we want to work towards that step by step.
I think that's perfect. And it's something that I've told him before, so this won't be anything new, that it's not fair that it's not reciprocal, the sharing.
Totally. Because if these were healthy conversations, he would love opening up to you. I mean, that is what a healthy, loving conversation is two people opening up about themselves. This is like he's got this insecurity in his head that's itching every day. And the way it gets scratched is Vanessa tells him what she's doing and who she's with. And that does not end well for anybody. Like either you do that every day for the rest of your life or something breaks.
Right. He says this one thing that always bothers me. He says like he'll get upset, but he always comes back. And
he's not losing anything. Of course he's going to come back. Well, he's literally risking nothing. So of course he's good.
Exactly. And what I want to say, and I never do because I know it only, because usually when he says that is after the fight and we're back on better ground. Like it bothers me because I always think, what an ass that you assume that I will be here for you to come back to.
Absolutely. He makes it sound like he's doing you a favor.
I feel like he uses his lack of presence as a punishment.
With Vanessa, there is a vast web constructed over years of emotional entanglement between her and Vince. Not only does infidelity start with porous boundaries, but it perpetuates porous boundaries because of the necessary discretion. They need to share a secret email account and calendars because they're not allowed to communicate in normal, healthy ways. And once sharing an email account, it's not hard for Vince to start imposing into other areas of Vanessa's life. I ended by giving Vanessa the homework of cutting out some of these entanglements, partly because they're unhealthy and promote unhealthy behavior, but also because in toxic relationships like this, practicing the little no's can actually go a long way. This is because toxic relationships are inherently fragile. They depend on both the narcissist and the codependent constantly validating one another to survive. So as soon as one person refuses to play that game, things will often unravel quickly. But Vanessa's not the only person I talk to who struggles with the little no's. Remember Jerry? Well, it's a month later now. He took that vacation with his new girlfriend. If you recall, he was anxious and fearful of getting too close with her. We talked about the vacation on our next phone call.
So how are you?
I'm awesome.
Good.
Really, really awesome. Last time we spoke, it was just before Mother's Day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to see my new girlfriend's family.
Yeah, you were going to do a trip together.
Yeah. And I was a little anxious about that.
How'd it go?
It went great.
Yeah?
It went great. It was easy.
It's supposed to be easy.
Is it?
Well, it's a good sign. When it's easy, that means that it's something's right.
One of the things I was going to talk to you about is, what are you looking for, you know, in the new relationship? And I guess the meeting of the in-laws should go easy is maybe one of those things.
It's a nice little litmus test. And it's funny coming from a background like yours. And I know I kind of felt this when my wife and I started dating. I was so used to relationships being hard and like fighting through everything and like fighting with her or like fighting myself or dealing with bullshit that I remember when I ended up in a relationship where like everything just felt easy and good. It was shocking.
I can relate to that. I feel a little bit like that. Is this too good to be true?
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute. This is supposed to be much harder than this.
Yeah. It's not. It's supposed to be easy.
I'm encouraged by that because I had a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was this idea. So I did my homework. I went back. I read chapter 8.
Okay.
And that was important. But one of those things that really hit me over the head was this idea of avoiding conflict, because I do that. I avoid that at all cost. And then you wrote about that I'm a person that is entitled.
Yeah.
Because I think that I shouldn't have to deal with anything. And so I thought maybe you could talk about that a little bit, because that's what I do. That chapter really hit home with me because I avoid conflict. I want everything to be smooth all the time. And I see myself doing that now in this new relationship, not stirring up any trouble.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because entitlement comes in various forms. And it sounds like maybe your form is thinking that things shouldn't ever be uncomfortable. When you avoid conflict, you're implying that I shouldn't have to deal with discomfort or deal with anything that's painful. And
yeah,
that's just life. You know, it's just none of us are above not having to deal with bullshit. We all have to deal with it. And it's actually the avoidance of it and not taking responsibility for engaging in healthy conflict. You know, it's a form of entitlement. It's like, oh, I'm above this. I don't deserve to have to fight with somebody. So I'm just going to like go play golf and pretend nothing happened.
Yeah, I do some of that. You know, in the old days, in the previous life, I went and got, you know, wasted.
Yeah, that's another way.
And so I don't do that anymore. More recently, it's been, you know, be a workaholic, bury yourself in your work and avoid your fucked up marriage.
But the funny thing, though, is I think people, especially people like us who grew up or have a long history of unhealthy relationships, we are used to conflict that is meaningless or counterproductive. We're used to just bullshit drama that doesn't really get anywhere or help anything. And so we kind of operate from the assumption that just conflict is bad. It, you know, a big aha moment for me was the realization that there is healthy conflict. Conflict helps things sometimes.
Yeah, you talk about in that in the book that it's critical that you have conflict because you learn how to trust.
Yes, you learn who's sticking with you for you and who's there for the benefits.
So what's healthy conflict look like?
Healthy conflict, I think, it's rooted in respect and it's rooted in each individual taking responsibility for themselves. So I'll talk about each one separately. So the respect piece, let's say you and your new girlfriend disagree about how clean an apartment should be, or like,
I'll give you an example.
Okay,
I prefer my apartment to be on the warm side. She prefers it to be prefers it to be a meat locker.
Yeah, yeah. Classic relationship problem.
Yeah, and so what do? I wear a parka around because I don't want to be a pussy and like can't stand it too cold.
Well, so. In that context, the respect piece would be like, well, it's Jerry's apartment, so he can keep it whatever temperature he wants, and I just deal with it. Or, hey, she prefers it like this, so, you know, let's find a happy medium. Conflict goes south the second it stops being about people with different preferences or different values, and it becomes, you are a worse person than me because you believe this.
Okay.
To use the cleanliness thing, it's like a fight over, say, making the bed or something, they would be like, hey, it makes me really happy when the bed is made. Like, do you mind taking 2 minutes
each day and just making it because that means a lot to me and it doesn't take much from you. And your response is like, well, I respect you and I want you to be happy. And yeah, it's not much for me to give up, so I'm willing to do that. That's kind of a conflict, a healthy conflict that comes from respect. An unhealthy version of that conflict would be, you don't make your bed. You're an undisciplined, lazy slob. I can't believe I'm with you. And then, you know, and then of course you would be like, well, who makes their bed every day? Like this isn't a military barracks. Like what, get off your high horse, you know? And so it's just that it's as soon as that judgment of a person's worth enters into the equation, it becomes very unhealthy. The other side of it is responsibility. So healthy conflict involves two people who take responsibility for their own emotions and expect the other person to take responsibility for their emotions. So classic unhealthy way to have a fight about something is to simply say, it's your fault I'm so upset right now. Nobody can actually make you feel something.
So that's an important thing to kind of keep an eye out for, you know, when you do have these conflicts. Right. I mean, I've been kind of like looking for red flags and there haven't been any. I just don't want to make the same mistakes over again.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say, you know, with the responsibility piece, it's amazing how simply changing the words you say a tiny bit completely changes the nature of the fight. So the difference between saying you made me upset and saying I feel upset when you do X. It sounds almost like the exact same sentence, but there's a subtle but important difference in that when I say I feel upset when you do XYZ, I'm retaining my responsibility for my reaction. So, you know, I could say like, when you don't call me, I get very worried and upset. And so it would help me manage my feelings if you were able to change your behavior in such a way. And then that way she can be like, okay, yeah, I'm willing to do that. But when I'm like, it's your fault I feel this way and fuck you and fuck the horse you came in on, you know, suddenly she's put in a space where she can't win. There's actually a book that talks about changing your language a little bit. It's called Nonviolent Communication. It's extremely useful because it just points out tons of like very subtle differences in wording and how that affects people and how simply changing two words in a sentence can be the difference between your partner feeling very defensive and offended versus your partner feeling like, oh, wait, let me help you. Let's find a compromise.
I can see that.
So you did the Mother's Day thing. I thought you were doing a vacation too.
We did. Yeah. So we got back from that and then home a week. And then we went to California for a week and did 24/7.
Wow.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was awesome. That's that, like, wait a minute. Why is this so easy? Am I being tricked?
Yeah, like, what's the catch here?
What's the catch? There's got to be a catch.
That's great, man.
All right, so that's really helpful on this conflict thing. It's like, have healthy conflict. It's okay. Don't.
But, you know, sometimes we have to fight about something, you know? Like, sometimes there's a big disagreement, and
I know. We haven't had a fight yet about anything.
Yeah. It'll happen.
Well, we did have a conversation about that whole air conditioning thing. and she's like, hey, if it's too cold, just say so.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to whine about every little thing. I'm too cold. She's like, if you're freezing, that's not good either. So,
what would you rather be, freezing or a whiner?
Yeah, exactly. I'd rather, much rather be freezing. You know, so she was actually trying to say, hey, speak up, you know, stop doing that.
But, you know, she has a point, which is, and this is something to consider, because think about it this way. If you're not willing to speak up about the cold air, you know, what if something legit comes along?
Yeah.
You know, like she needs to know that if something's wrong, you're willing to speak up about it.
Yeah. And she doesn't think that. She already at this point, it's been 6 months, she already thinks that I'm not going to say anything about anything.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you don't.
Well, I don't.
Sounds like you just sit there and freeze.
Hey, you're right. She's right. So that's an area for I can do a little work on.
Yeah.
And I need to go. I need to get home and pick a fight when I get home tonight.
Here we see a parallel between Jerry's behavior and Vanessa's. Because Vanessa's afraid to say no, she lets Vince encroach further and further into her life. Because Jerry's unwilling to say no, he's failing to build trust within the relationship. His girlfriend can't rely on him to speak up when something's wrong. Like Vanessa, Jerry is codependent. The difference is, whereas Vince sounds like a raging narcissist, Jerry's fortunately found a woman who is confident and secure and encourages him to enforce his own boundaries.
Think about it this way too. It's if you were able to do that, if you were able to say like, hey, I really kind of want to like have a night to myself tonight. If you were able to say that every once in a while, then when you do say you want to hang out with her, that becomes that much more significant to her. Cause then she knows you like really want to see her. Like if you say, I want to see you tonight, like she knows that's for real. That's like, cause she knows you're able to say the opposite. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's where our problem is. So this is good stuff for me because this is the stuff I need to actually do it and not think about it.
Yeah, and I think little things like that are the best starting points because what happens is if you let this stuff snowball, 20 years later, you get your last marriage.
Yeah, I get resentment all over the place.
Yeah, and pretty soon you've got like massive fucking elephants in the room that nobody's talking about.
Yeah, you're right.
Start with the air conditioner, you know, just be like, hey, I'm cold. Can I turn it up?
And she'll say, sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
That'll be the end of that.
Pretty much. And you'll be like, oh, thank God. And she won't even notice.
I know. So stupid. It sounds that way. Sounds worse when you verbalize some of this stuff.
It's funny how warped stuff gets when it sits in our head.
Yeah. All right. I got a new project for you.
Okay.
Okay. So the ex-wife,
mm-hmm.
I need you to decipher this text message that she sent me.
Okay.
I was kind of being left alone, kind of not. And then it was recent. She says, maybe someday when the pain passes on my end, you can sincerely explain to me how to get through this and how you get on with your life. Forgetting the past 20 years with such emptiness and no empathy or sentiment at all. I haven't figured it out. I know you're in love and have forgotten me.
So here's Jerry's narcissist codependent dynamic. His ex is narcissistically holding him responsible for her feelings. But he's in a new relationship now. He can't be responsible for his ex's feelings. The key here is to break him out of this pattern.
So this is actually an excellent example. You know, in that message, she is making assumptions about your feelings. She says things like, you've forgotten me and you've moved on. And that is a perfect example of a violation boundary in terms of assuming somebody's emotions and also expecting them to take responsibility for your emotions. So she's saying things like, maybe you can explain to me how you feel this way and how I can stop hurting this much. And it's, she doesn't know how you feel. She doesn't know what you went through.
No.
So obviously she's hurt. She's very upset. And she's taking that out towards you. As I recall, you said that she was like texting you like every day for months.
Yeah, there was a whole string. And this was all kind of around that whole Mother's Day. And, you know, it just kept going. And actually I did something, I did a little better job of setting some boundaries because there were more texts before that.
Yeah.
And she called me heartless and she feels sorry for me that I can simply dismiss our life together. And then I texted her back, don't text me.
Yeah.
I said, I told her I'd like to be left alone. And I said, I can block you. And then came that passage that I read to you.
Yeah, this is exactly the wrong way to have conflict. And it's the wrong way. I mean, speaking for her now, too, it's not going to make her feel any better either. I mean, I know she's doing it. She's in pain and needs to get it out. But like,
doing stuff like that just makes it worse, not better.
Is the best thing for me to do is to just ignore them?
I think so. And if it really starts bothering you, I mean, I would consider blocking her. I would absolutely consider it.
It is. It has this huge impact because, you know, I feel like I'm trying to get on with my life and I want to feel like my marriage is over, you know, and I want to feel like I'm in fate, you know, a new phase of my life and not being pulled back into the old one, which was so unhappy for me and so destructive. And it just keeps pulling me back. She pulls me back. And I get on a good flow. Everything's going great. And I'm in my new life and I'm happy. And then I get dragged back.
Yeah.
And I'm tired of that.
Yeah, I would block her. You know, it doesn't have to be permanent.
Yeah.
Because she's not helping herself either. As long as you're an outlet for her, she's never forced to come to terms with her own stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've been permitting it, you know?
Yeah, and the whole beautiful thing about boundaries in general is, like, the more you're able to assert boundaries effectively, the more it forces the people around you to adopt healthy boundaries as well. You stop enabling people, and people stop enabling you. I encourage Jerry to set up boundaries in his life because it is the common problem I see across all of his relationships. He struggles with his ex-wife because he doesn't know when or how to cut her off. And he struggles with his new relationship because he doesn't know when it's appropriate to broach certain subjects. As Jerry steels himself to have difficult conversations about air conditioners and apartments, I meet up again with Mimi. Mimi has been struggling to set boundaries of her own. In this case, with the weird, sexy background guy who keeps randomly showing up in her life.
When we last left you, you had Mr. Hovering Person.
We can call him New Jersey.
Mr. Hovering New Jersey. has anything happened with him? Have you talked
to
him?
Yeah, I definitely followed through on that. A few days later, you know, he came over and he has stayed at my house before. So it wasn't new that he stayed over at my house again. But in the morning, like, we were just talking and I was like, you know, do not swallow this. Like, this is your opportunity. But yeah, I mean, I just kind of like opened up and I said to him, what is this? When I first met you, like off the bat, he was behaving very affectionately towards me. So I thought it was a safe thing to do. And I went in and kissed him. And so what I said to him, I started off this conversation as I was like, the first time that I met you, I took a risk and you made it very clear that you don't want me kissing you. But in the time since, your behavior says the opposite. Yeah. You know, it's been like this weird back and forth. And I'm like, you know, it's just really frustrating for me because, you know, you made a boundary clear that you don't want me kissing you. But then at the same time, like, you are very persistent. You keep calling me. You're very affectionate towards me. This leaves me in a very confusing spot. If you want a friendship with me, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But like, I don't cuddle with my friends in bed. Like, and that right. is literally what we are doing right now. So like, I'm just looking for some clarity on what this means to you and what you hope to come of this. You know how I feel about you, and I haven't kept that a secret, but you haven't really been very forward with me on what it is that you want. And like, it took him a minute to really say anything. And like, some of what he was saying at first didn't really make a lot of sense. Like, he started talking about something about bullying, like almost like he was referencing when he was younger, like, oh, you know, when you're bullied and blah, blah, it makes it harder for you to want to like speak up. And I'm like, okay. And then he went into talking about, I mean, he recently moved to New York, like within the last year. He was like, you know, it's been a really hard adjustment, like moving to the city and like the change of lifestyle and everything. I'm like, okay. And then he just straight up said, he's like, I'm still working through my last relationship and I'm not emotionally available. And I'm like, okay,
yeah,
that's fine. But again,
like, yeah, so
like, it's okay. Like, yeah. I'm okay with that. And thank you for telling me. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, here we are.
Yeah.
In my bed. It's not the first time. It gave me clarity in that he actually said he's not emotionally available, but he still behaves towards me as though he wants something from me. So like, about a week or so later, he was like, hey, do you want to go see Solo because he knows I'm a total Star Wars nerd. And he had dropped the ball the last time I tried to get us tickets, and he got us tickets, and he was framing it like a date. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll go. The whole time. Now, granted, I had had a couple of drinks, but the whole time, he's still very affectionate towards me. In the movie, he's like snuggling on my shoulder and like we're sharing a drink, and like just all of that behavior to me is saying that this is somebody that wants some kind of intimacy with me.
Yeah.
But like, even though like I'm drinking, like there's something that just feels a little uneasy about this. And, you know, when I drink, I get a little sassy. So we were leaving later and I just started to get a little sassy with him. I'm like, but you're not emotionally available to me. And he was just like, please stop. Please stop. Please stop. Not, he wasn't being a dick, but yeah, he was just like, please stop. And I'm like, you stop, man. Like, like, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to tell me? Like, this is like a really weird hamster wheel to be on. And I didn't want to engage the conversation any further because I was like, I knew that I was kind of drunk and I knew that we were on our way home. And
bad idea.
So that's kind of where it stands right now. Like, mm-hmm. We did have an honest conversation. I got what I thought was clarity on his end.
It's interesting. I talk to a number of men who had suffered like really bad bullying when they were younger, and it really does fuck with people. This guy sounds to me like he has, I mean, clearly he likes you.
Clearly. I mean, yes.
Obviously.
Obviously.
But it sounds like he has a lot of issues opening himself up. So first of all, thank you for talking to him. Thank you.
Yeah.
You get an A+.
Thank
on your
you.
Homework.
Goes on my report card. Sweet.
That's a big step.
Yeah.
So the whole thing about clarity and boundaries, it's one thing to talk to somebody about it, and you get kind of a muddy answer that could kind of mean anything. Ultimately, boundaries are defined by actions. It's the way you determine them is you express, these are my expectations for your actions. And this is how I'm going to behave in response. A simple boundary thing would be like, I expect you to call me if you're going to be late, you know, and if you don't do that, I'm going to go home. And so in this situation, I think a boundary needs to be drawn, which is, yeah, I think there's probably more stuff going on with you, but I think this whole kind of nebulous thing with him seems to be kind of occupying your emotional space at the moment. So the goal here is to establish some sort of boundary with him, which is like, look, okay, either we are boyfriend and girlfriend or we're just friends. It's one or the other.
Yeah. There's no both.
There's no more in between.
Yeah.
If we're friends, we're not cuddling. You're not sleeping over. Like,
yeah,
you're not coming up and like nuzzling your head in my shoulder in front of my friends. Like, it's, we're friends.
Yeah.
And if we are dating, I wouldn't even, it sounds like he's terrified of commitment, so I wouldn't even frame it as like a relationship, just call it dating.
Yeah.
If we are dating, then yeah, I'd love to do that stuff. But we need to be clear that we're dating. So a lot of people who this tends to be more common in men. Men who struggle with their emotions or feelings, they need time to process. It's not, the way you described like the conversation, he sounds like one of those guys that when you say something to him, he's not going to have an answer right away. His initial response is going to be a little bit of a freak out, like, oh my God. But then if you give him like space, if you give him like 5 minutes, the process and think about it, he'll eventually show up to the right answer. But yeah, I think the next step is to kind of make that boundary declaration in some way.
Quick lesson. Actions never lie and words don't mean shit. You can tell someone that you will be with them into the ends of the earth, but if you don't fucking show up on day one, your words are worthless. One thing I harp on, especially with the codependent types, is to always pay attention to people's actions. This is why I explain boundaries to Mimi in terms of creating clear-cut if-then results, depending on New Jersey's actions. If he does this, then great. If he does that, then no bueno.
It's an interesting situation because, like you said, he's not an asshole.
He's not.
He's not mistreating you.
No.
It's like you like each other. It's just the current situation is not a healthy situation for either of you. And if he doesn't oblige with that, like if he kind of still tries to do the same stuff, then at that point you have to be like,
No.
Dude.
Like,
did you not
okay.
Did you not hear me? Yeah. We talked last time about your former self and then mm-hmm. your current self, that you've done a lot of work on yourself and grown a lot. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, one of the aspects of your former self is that you had no boundaries, that your mm-hmm. ex-boyfriends would just do crazy shit and run all over you. And, you know, so this is another manifestation of the new you. This is a good thing to get comfortable doing. Because it's something that going forward, whether it's with this guy or some completely other guy you meet in the future, it's an important tool. Any dates with anybody else, or are you just chilling?
I met a guy at a party.
Ooh.
Yeah. This was post the talk with New Jersey.
Okay.
A friend of mine was having a going away party because she's moving upstate, as they do. I came after teaching, so I wasn't exactly the portrait of a woman trying to woo people. But yeah, I mean, like this guy friend of hers showed up and she like introduced him to three people at the same time, including me. But he was like Velcro to me the rest of the night. Like he mm-hmm. remembered my name, didn't remember the other one. So I was like, oh, this is kind of cute. So we ended up pretty much hanging out the whole night. And then we went for a drink afterwards. And really cool. Like he's also a body worker. He's been like an energy worker and body worker for a long time. We have a lot of similar past experiences with addiction problems mm-hmm. and recovery. But yeah, I mean, this guy, really cool, really sweet. He's currently living in Philly, but is moving here within the next month or so. Yeah, I mean, we've been casually keeping in touch. He's since come back once and we hung out. Technically, he's not really available either because he doesn't live here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I am being a little bit cautious about that. And so I'm cognizant of it.
Was there any kissing?
No.
Yeah. So nothing overtly romantic.
No, definitely flirting.
Yeah.
Definitely flirting and a lot of talking and a lot of connection. And, you know, he's very open with sharing his past. And I know that he recently came out of a long-term relationship and he was really open and sharing about that. I wasn't getting the sense that he was hung up on it at all.
So now you have two homework assignments.
Oh, great. All right.
One is to define clear boundaries with New Jersey. Same deal. Kind, respectful. I like you. You're a great guy. But mm-hmm. like, we need to choose. Second one is the guy from Philly. I'm assuming you guys keep in touch, and when he comes, you hang out again.
Yeah.
You are romantically interested in him, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your second homework assignment is to pretty overtly state that to him. Because the one sense I get from you, just kind of hearing about a lot of your other dating stories, there could be a million reasons for this, mm-hmm. but it sounds like at least a certain amount of time, the men that you're dating and seeing, like, that's not so clear to them. For whatever reason, and it could be, you know, you're not communicating it clearly. It could be you're not even aware of how you're coming across. But, like, challenge to you is to state that clearly. And it could be just something just really as simple as, like, you know, you're flirting and just be like, you know, I'm really into you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. No, you're totally
accomplished.
Right. Yeah. I'm not really sure when the next time I'm going to see him is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's really a text conversation.
No.
That is a face-to-face conversation.
Yeah, and we're not going to see each other for two more months. So this is all contingent on, you know, you do keep in touch and you do see him again. And it is all also contingent that you are still into him. I think that would be a useful thing to just try and see what happens. I have a feeling it's one of those little things that would make a big difference.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you tend to attract men who are also a little bit on the more passive side. I'm kind of going out on a limb on that, but like mm-hmm. that's just kind of a gut feeling I get from talking to you for a while and talking about your interactions with men.
Mm.
And it's funny because like a lot of guys, they just need a little nudge.
Yeah.
They're so nervous and kind of caught up in their own head. So, but like if you just give them that like little signal, like, hey, I like you.
Yeah.
You know, then they're like, I can like, you know, do this and call her again and, you know, kiss her. And like, it's a little bit of a green light for them.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, that's definitely a skill that I need to clarify more. And yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
I like you. I don't like you.
Yeah.
Fuck it. Deal with it.
Yeah. Deal with it. Yeah. Deal with it. Like, I mean, I'm guilty of it. I definitely have allowed people to behave in certain ways that they probably should not around me. And I've tolerated it.
Yeah.
You know, tolerated. It's hard to allow myself to get angry enough to the point of where I'm like that forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the cultural pressures on women is definitely for them to kind of shut up and deal with it.
Yeah.
And obviously that's changing, and yeah. You can be part of that change.
I can be part of that change. Yes, it's gonna take work, but yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Three people, three different examples of poor boundaries. Vanessa's codependency is a fairly active codependency. It involves saying yes too often to too many things. Mimi's codependency is more passive. She keeps things ambiguous forever. You can't get hurt if no one's asked for anything. Jerry, on the other hand, is like that kid at school who is easily startled. He winces at the slightest sign of conflict, yet the conflict never comes. Conversations that establish boundaries, that clearly define what is acceptable and unacceptable, that take ownership for one's own actions and emotions and expect the other person to do the same, are, by definition, difficult conversations. They are difficult because they are emotionally risky. They can upset people. They can cause us to feel hurt or isolated or misunderstood. They can challenge our understanding of our relationships and force others to do the same. This probably won't surprise you, but people don't like that. They will resist it, and often they will even fight back in various ways. Thus, conflict emerges. If getting to a healthy place in a relationship is about having healthy boundaries, and having healthy boundaries requires having conflict, well, then one could say that the key to getting good at relationships is getting good at conflict. In the next chapter, we will look at how to do conflict well. Some of it is obvious. Communicate well, have some self-awareness, stop fucking lying, and so on. But some of it is not so obvious. In the next case, we'll see conflict done poorly. We'll see it become a struggle for power. And that struggle involves horses, dogs, and an ill-advised trip to Mexico.